This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Cerulean Sins by Laurel K. Hamilton. Read for you by Cynthia Holloway.
To Jay, who says yes more than he says no, who never makes me feel like a freak, and who came up with the title for this book. Chapter 1. It was early September, a busy time of year for raising the dead. The pre-Halloween rush seemed to start earlier and earlier every year. Every animator at Animators, Inc. was booked solid. I was no exception. In fact, I'd been offered more work than even my ability to go without sleep could supply. Mr. Leo Harlan should have been grateful to get the appointment. He didn't look grateful. Truthfully, he didn't have the look of anything. Harlan was medium. Medium height, dark hair but not too dark. Skin neither pale nor too tan. Eyes brown, but an indistinguishable shade of brown. In fact, the most remarkable thing about Mr. Harlan was that there was nothing remarkable about him. Even his suit was dark, conservative, a businessman's outfit that had been in style for the last 20 years, and probably would still be in style 20 years down the road. His shirt was white. His tie neatly knotted, his not-too-big, not-too-small hands were well-groomed, but not manicured. His appearance told me so little that that in itself was interesting and vaguely disturbing. I took a sip from my coffee mug with the motto, "If you slip me decaf, I'll rip your head off." I'd brought it to work when our boss Bert had put decaf in the coffee maker without telling anyone, thinking we wouldn't notice. Half the office thought they had mono for a week, until we discovered Bert's dastardly plot. The coffee that our secretary, Mary, had gotten from Mr. Harlan sat on the edge of my desk. His mug was the one with the logo of Animators, Inc. on it. He'd taken a minute sip of the coffee when Mary had first handed it to him. He'd taken the coffee black, but he sipped it like he hadn't tasted it, or it really didn't matter what it tasted like. He had taken it out of politeness, not out of desire. I sipped my own coffee, heavy on the sugar and cream, trying to make up for the late work the night before. Caffeine and sugar, the two basic food groups. His voice was like the rest of him. So ordinary, it was extraordinary. He spoke with absolutely no accent, no hint of region or country. "I want you to raise my ancestor, Miss Blake." "So you said." "You seem to doubt me, Miss Blake." "Call it skepticism." "Why would I come in here and lie to you?" I shrugged. "People have done it before." "I assure you, Miss Blake, I am telling the truth." Trouble was, I just didn't believe him. Maybe I was being paranoid, but my left arm under the nice navy suit jacket was crisscrossed with scars, from the crooked cross-shaped burn scar where a vampire servant had branded me, to the slashing claw marks of a shape-shifted witch. Plus knife scars, thin and clean compared to the rest. My right arm had only one knife scar. It was nothing in comparison. And there were other scars hidden under the navy skirt and royal blue shell. Silk didn't care if it slid over scars or smooth, untouched skin. I'd earned my right to be paranoid. "What ancestor do you want raised, and why?" I smiled when I said it, pleasant, but the smile didn't reach my eyes. I'd begun to have to work at getting my smiles to reach all the way up to my eyes. He smiled, too, and it left his eyes as unaffected as my own. "Smile because you were smiled at, not because it really meant anything." He reached out to pick up the coffee mug again, and this time I noticed a heaviness in the left front of his jacket. He wasn't wearing a shoulder holster, I'd have noticed that, but there was something heavier than a wallet in his left breast pocket. It could have been a lot of things, but my first thought was, gun. I've learned to listen to my first thoughts. You're not paranoid if people really are out to get you. I had my own gun tucked under my left arm in a shoulder holster. That had evened things up. But I didn't want to turn my office into the OK Corral. He had a gun. Maybe. Probably. For all I knew, it could have been a really heavy cigar case. But I'd have bet almost anything that that heaviness was a weapon. I could either sit here and try to talk myself out of that belief, or I could act as if I was right. If I was wrong, I'd apologize later, If I was right, well, I'd be alive. Better alive and rude than dead and polite. I interrupted his talk about his family tree. I hadn't really heard any of it. I was fixated on that heaviness in his pocket. Until I found out whether it was a gun or not, nothing else much mattered to me. I smiled and forced it up into my eyes. What is it exactly that you do for a living, Mr. Harlan? He drew a slightly deeper breath, settling into his chair just a bit. It was the closest thing I'd seen to tension in the man. The first real human movement. People fidget. Harlan didn't. People don't like dealing with people who raise the dead. Don't ask me why, but we make them nervous. Harlan wasn't nervous. He wasn't anything. He was just sitting across the desk from me, chilling, nondescript eyes, pleasant and empty. I was betting he'd lied about his reason for coming here, and that he'd brought a gun hidden on his person in a place that wasn't easy to spot. I was liking Leo Harlan less and less. I sat my coffee mug gently on my desk blotter, still smiling. I'd freed up my hands, which is step one. Drawing my gun would be step two. I was hoping to avoid that step. I want you to raise one of my ancestors, Miss Blake. I don't see where my work has any relevance here.
Humor me, I said, still smiling, but feeling it slide out of my eyes like melting ice.
Why should I? He said.
Because if you don't, I'll refuse to take your case.
Mr. Vaughn, your boss, has already taken my money. He accepted on your behalf. I smiled, and this time it held real humor.
Actually, Bert is only the business manager at Animators, Inc. now. Most of us are full partners in the firm, like a law firm. Bert still handles the business end of things, but he's not exactly my boss anymore.
His face, if it was possible, went quieter, more closed, more secretive. It was like looking at a bad painting, one that had all the technicalities down, yet held no feel of life. The only humans I'd ever seen that could be this closed down were scary ones.
I wasn't aware of your change in status, Miss Blake.
His voice had gone a tone deeper, but it was as empty as his face. He was ringing every alarm bell I had. My shoulders were tight with the need to pull my gun first. My hand slid downward without me thinking about it. It wasn't until his hands raised to the arms of his chair that I realized what I'd done. We were both maneuvering to a better position to draw down. Suddenly there was tension, thick and heavy, like invisible lightning in the room. There was no more doubt. I saw it in his empty eyes and the small smile on his face. This was a real smile, no fake, no pretense. We were seconds away from doing one of the most real things one human being can do to another. We were about to try to kill each other. I watched, not his eyes, but his upper body, waiting for that betraying movement. There was no more doubt. We both knew. Into that heavy, heavy tension, his voice fell like a stone thrown down a deep well. His voice alone almost made me go for my gun. I am a contract killer, but I am not here for you, Anita Blake. I didn't take my eyes from his body. The tension didn't slacken.
Why tell me, then?
My voice was softer than his, almost breathy.
Because I haven't come to St. Louis to kill anyone. I really am interested in getting my ancestor raised from the dead.
Why?
I asked, still watching his body, still treading the tension. Even hitmen have hobbies, Miss Blake. His voice was matter-of-fact, but his body stayed very, very still. I realized suddenly that he was trying not to spook me. I let my gaze flick to his face. It was still bland, still unnaturally empty, but it also held something else. A trace of humor.
What's so funny? I asked.
I didn't know that coming to see you was tempting fate.
What do you mean?
I was trying to hold on to that edge of tension, but it was slipping away. He sounded too ordinary, too suddenly real for me to keep thinking about drawing a gun and shooting up my office. It suddenly seemed a little silly. And yet, looking into his dead eyes that humor never completely filled, it didn't seem all that silly.
There are people all over the world who would love to see me dead, Ms. Blake. There are people who have spent considerable money and effort to see that such a thing would happen. But no one has come close. Until today.
I shook my head. This wasn't close.
Normally, I'd agree with you, but I knew something of your reputation, so I didn't wear a gun in my usual manner. You noticed the weight of it when I bent forward that last time, didn't you? I nodded. If we'd had to draw down on each other, your holster is a few seconds faster than this inner jacket shit that I'm wearing.
Then why wear it? I asked.
I didn't want to make you nervous by coming in here armed, but I don't go anywhere unarmed, so I thought I'd be slick and you wouldn't notice.
I almost didn't.
Thanks for that, but we both know better. I wasn't sure about that, but I let it go. No need to argue when I seem to be winning.
What do you really want, Mr. Harlan, if that is your real name?
He smiled at that. As I've said, I really do want my ancestor raised from the dead. I didn't lie about that.
He seemed to think about it for a second.
Strange, but I haven't lied about anything. He looked puzzled. It's been a long time since that was true.
My condolences, I said.
He frowned at me.
What?
It must be difficult never being able to tell the truth. I know I'd find it exhausting. He smiled, and again it was that slight flexing of the lips that seemed to be his genuine smile.
I haven't thought about it in a long time.
He shrugged. I guess you get used to it. It was my turn to shrug.
Maybe. What ancestor do you want raised, and why?
Why what? Why do you want to raise this particular ancestor? Does it matter? He asked.
Yes.
Why? Because I don't believe the dead should be disturbed without a good reason. That small smile flexed again. You've got animators in this town that raise zombies every night for entertainment.
I nodded.
Then by all means, go to one of them. They'll do anything you want, pretty much, if the price is right. Can they raise a corpse that is almost 200 years old?
I shook my head.
Out of their league.
I heard an animator could raise almost anything if they were willing to do a human sacrifice.
His voice was quiet. I shook my head again.
Don't believe everything you hear, Mr. Harlan. Some animators could raise a few hundred years' worth of corpse with the help of a human sacrifice. Of course, that would be murder, and thus illegal.
Rumor has it that you've done it.
Rumor can say anything it damn well pleases. I don't do human sacrifice.
So you can't raise my ancestor.
He made it a flat statement.
I didn't say that.
His eyes widened, the closest to surprise that he'd shown.
You can raise a nearly 200-year-old corpse without a human sacrifice?
I nodded.
Rumor said that too, but I didn't believe it.
So you believe that I did human sacrifice, but not that I could raise a few hundred years' worth of dead people on my own?
He shrugged. I'm used to killing other people. I've never seen anyone raised from the dead.
Lucky you.
He smiled and his eyes thawed just a little. So you'll raise my ancestor. If you tell me a good enough reason for doing it.
You don't get distracted much, do you, Miss Blake?
Tenacious, that's me, I said and smiled. Maybe I'd spent too much time around really bad people, but now that I knew that Leo Harlan wasn't here to kill me or anyone else in town, I had no problem with him.
Why did I believe him? For the same reason I hadn't believed him the first time. Instinct.
I've followed the records of my family in this country far back as I can, but my original ancestor is on no official documents. I believe he gave a false name from the beginning. Until I get his true name, I can't track my family through Europe. I very much wish to do that.
Raise him, ask his real name, his real reason for coming to this country, and put him back?
I made it a question.
Harlan nodded.
Exactly.
Sounds reasonable enough.
So you'll do it, he said.
Yes, but it ain't cheap. I'm probably the only animator in this country that can raise someone this old without using a human sacrifice. It's sort of a seller's market, if you catch my drift.
In my own way, Miss Blake, I'm as good at my job as you are at yours.
He tried to look humble and failed. He looked pleased with himself, all the way to those ordinary and frightening brown eyes.
I can pay, Miss Blake. Never fear.
I mentioned an outrageous figure. He never flinched. He started to reach to the inside of his jacket. I said, don't.
My credit card, Miss Blake, nothing more.
He took his hands out of his jacket and held them, fingers spread so I could see them clearly. You can finish the paperwork and pay in the outer office. I've got other appointments.
He almost smiled.
Of course.
He stood. I stood. Neither of us offered to shake hands. He hesitated at the door. I stopped a ways back, not following as closely as I normally do. Room to maneuver, you know.
When can you do the job?
I'm booked solid this week. I might be able to squeeze you in next Wednesday, maybe next Thursday.
What happened to next Monday and Tuesday? He asked.
I shrugged. Booked up.
You said, and I quote, I'm booked solid this week. Then you mentioned next Wednesday.
I shrugged again. There was a time when I wasn't good at lying. Even now I'm not great at it, but not for the same reasons. I felt my eyes going flat and empty as I said. I meant to say I was booked up for most of the next 2 weeks. He stared at me, hard enough to make me want to squirm. I fought off the urge and just gave him blank, vaguely friendly eyes.
Next Tuesday is the night of the full moon. He said it in a quiet voice.
I blinked at him, fighting to keep the surprise off my face, and I think I succeeded, but I failed on my body language. My shoulders tensed, my hands flexed. Most people would notice your face, not the rest of you, but Harlan was a man who would notice. Damn it.
So, it's the full moon. Yippity-skippity, what of it?
My voice was as matter-of-fact as I could make it. He gave that small smile of his.
You're not very good at being coy, Miss Blake.
No, I'm not. But since I'm not being coy, that's not a problem.
Miss Blake, he said, voice almost cajoling, please do not insult my intelligence.
I thought about saying, but it's so easy, but didn't. First, it wasn't easy at all. Second, I was a little nervous about where this line of questioning was going, but I was not going to help him by volunteering information. Say less. It irritates people.
I haven't insulted your intelligence.
He made a frown that I think was as true as that small smile. The real Harlan peeking through.
Rumor says that you haven't worked on the night of the full moon for a few months now.
He seemed very serious all of a sudden. Not in a menacing way. Almost as if I'd been impolite, forgotten my table manners or something, and he was correcting me.
Maybe I'm Wiccan. The full moon is a holy day for them, you know. Or rather, night.
Are you Wiccan, Miss Blake?
It never took me long to grow tired of word games.
No, Mr. Harlan, I am not.
Then why do you not work on the night of the full moon?
He was studying my face, searching it, as if for some reason the answer were more important than it should have been. I knew what he wanted me to say. He wanted me to confess to being a shapeshifter of some kind. Trouble was I couldn't confess, because it wasn't true. I was the first human Namir Ra, leopard queen of a were-leopard part in their history. I'd inherited the leopards when I was forced to kill their old leader, to keep him from killing me. I was also Bulverk of the local werewolf pack. Bulverk was more than a bodyguard, less than an executioner. It was basically someone who did the things that the Ulfric either couldn't or wouldn't do. Richard Zeman was the local Ulfric. He'd been my off-again, on-again honey bun for a couple of years. Right now, it was off, very off. His parting shot to me had been,
I don't want to love someone who is more at home with the monsters than I am.
What do you say to that? What can you say? Damned if I know. They say love conquers everything. They lie. As Namir Ra and Bulverk, I had people depending on me. I took the full moon off so I'd be available. It was simple, really, and nothing that I was willing to share with Leo Harlan. I sometimes take personal days, Mr. Harlan. If they've coincided with the full moon, I assure you, it's coincidental.
Rumor says you got cut up by a shifter a few months back, and now you're one of them.
His voice was still quiet, but I was ready for this one. My face, my body, everything was calm, because he was wrong. I am not a shapeshifter, Mr. Harlan. His eyes narrowed.
I don't believe you, Miss Blake.
I sighed. I don't really care if you believe me, Mr. Harlan. My being a lycanthrope or not has no bearing on how good I am at raising the dead.
Rumor says you're the best, but you keep telling me that the rumors are wrong. Are you really as good as they say you are?
Better.
You're rumored to have raised entire graveyards.
I shrugged. You'll turn a girl's head with talk like that. Are you saying it's true?
Does it really matter? Let me repeat. I can raise your ancestor, Mr. Harlan. I'm one of the few, if not the only animator in this country that can do that without resorting to a human sacrifice. I smiled at him. My professional smile, the one that was all bright and shiny and as empty of meaning as a light bulb.
Will next Wednesday or Thursday be all right?
He nodded. I'll leave my cell phone number. You can reach me 24 hours a day. Are you in a hurry for this? Let's just say that I never know when an offer may come my way that I would find hard to resist.
Not just money, I said.
He gave that smile again. No, not just money, Miss Blake. I have enough money. But a job that holds new interests, new challenges. I'm always searching for that.
Be careful what you wish for, Mr. Harlan. There's always someone out there bigger and badder than you are.
I have not found it so. I smiled then. Either you're even scarier than you seem, or you haven't been meeting the right people.
He looked at me for a long moment, until I felt the smile slide from my eyes. I met his dead eyes with my own. In that moment, that well of quietness filled me. It was a peaceful place, the place I went when I killed. A great white static, empty place where nothing hurt, where nothing felt. Looking into Harlan's empty eyes, I wondered if his head was as white and empty and as staticky. I almost asked, but I didn't, because just for a second I thought he'd lied about it all, and he was going to try and draw his gun from his jacket. It would explain why he wanted to know if I was a shapeshifter. For a heartbeat or two, I thought I'd have to kill Mr. Leo Harlan. I wasn't scared now or nervous. I just readied myself. It was his choice, live or die. There was nothing but that slow, eternal second where choices are made and lives are lost. Then he shook himself. Almost like a bird settling its feathers back into place.
I was about to remind you that I am a very scary person all by myself. But I won't now. It would be stupid to keep playing with you like this, like poking a rattlesnake with a stick.
I just looked at him, with empty eyes still held in that quiet place. My voice came out slow, careful, like my body felt. I hope you haven't lied to me today, Mr. Harlan.
He gave me that unsettling smile.
So do I, Miss Blake. So do I.
With that odd comment, he opened the door carefully, never taking his eyes from me. Then he turned and left quickly, shutting the door firmly behind him, and left me alone with the adrenaline rush draining like a puddle to my feet. It wasn't fear that left me weak, but the adrenaline. I raised the dead for a living and was a legal vampire executioner. Wasn't that unique enough? Did I have to attract scary clients, too? I knew that I should have told Harlan no dice, but I had told him the truth. I could raise this zombie, and no one else in the country could do it, without a human sacrifice. I was pretty sure that if I turned it down, Harlan would find someone else to do it. Someone else that didn't have either my abilities or my morals. Sometimes you deal with the devil, not because you want to, but because if you don't, someone else will. Chapter 2. Lindell's cemetery was one of those new modern affairs, where all the headstones are low to the ground and you aren't allowed to plant flowers. It makes mowing easier, but it also makes for a depressingly empty space. Nothing but flat land with little oblong shapes in the dark. It was as empty and featureless as the dark side of the moon, and about as cheerful. Give me a cemetery with tombs and mausoleums, stone angels weeping over the portraits of children, the Mother Mary praying for us all, her silent eyes turned heavenward. A cemetery should have something to remind the people passing by that there is a heaven, and not just a hole in the ground with a rock on top of it. I was here to raise Gordon Bennington from the dead because Fidelis Insurance Company hoped he was a suicide, not an accidental death. There was a multi-million-dollar insurance claim at stake. The police had ruled the death accidental, but Fidelis wasn't satisfied. They opted to pay my rather substantial fee in the hopes of saving millions. I was expensive, but not that expensive. Compared to with what they stood to lose, I was a bargain. There were three groups of cars at the cemetery. Two of the groups were at least 50 feet apart because both Mrs. Bennington and Fidelis' head lawyer, Arthur Conroy, had restraining orders against each other. The third group of two cars was parked in between the others, a marked police car and an unmarked police car. Don't ask me to explain how I knew it was an unmarked police car. It just had that look. I parked a little in back of the first group of cars. I got out of my brand new Jeep Grand Cherokee, which was partially purchased by the money I got from my now-deceased Jeep Country Squire. The insurance company hadn't wanted to pay up on my claim. They didn't believe that we're hyenas had eaten the Country Squire. They sent out some people to take photos and measurements to see the bloodstains. They finally paid up, but they also dropped my policy. I'm paying month by month to a new company that will grant me a full policy if and only if I can manage not to destroy another car for 2 years. Fat chance of that. My sympathies were all for Gordon Bennington's family. Of course, it's hard to have sympathy for an insurance company that's trying to squirm out of paying a widow with 3 children. The cars closest to me turned out to be those of Fidelis Insurance. Arthur Conroy came towards me, hand outstretched. He was on the tall end of short, with thinning blonde hair that he combed over his bald spot, as if that hid it. Silver-framed glasses that circled large gray eyes. If his eyelashes and eyebrows had been darker, his eyes would have been his best feature. But his eyes were so large and unadorned that I thought he looked vaguely frog-like. But then maybe my recent disagreement with my insurance company had made me uncharitable. Maybe. Conroy was accompanied by a near-solid wall of other dark-suited men. I shook Conroy's hand and glanced behind him at the 2 6-foot-plus men. Bodyguards? I made it a question. Conroy's eyes widened. How did you know? I shook my head. They look like bodyguards, Mr. Conroy. I shook hands with the other 2 Fidelis people. I didn't offer to shake hands with the bodyguards. Most of them won't shake hands, even if you do offer. I don't know if it ruins the tough guy image or they just want to keep their gun hands free. Either way, I didn't offer, and neither did they. The dark-haired bodyguard with shoulders nearly as broad as I was tall smiled, though. So you're Anita Blake. And you are? Rex. Rex Conducci. I raised eyebrows at him. Is Rex really your first name? He laughed, that surprised burst of laughter that is so masculine, and usually at a woman's expense. No. I didn't bother to ask what his real first name was. Probably something embarrassing like Florence or Rosie. The second bodyguard was blonde and silent. He watched me with small pale eyes. I didn't like him. And you are? I asked. He blinked as if my asking had surprised him. Most people ignored bodyguards. Some out of fear or not knowing what to do, because they've never met one. Some because they've met one and figure they're just furniture, to be ignored until needed. He hesitated, then said, Balfour. I waited a second, but he didn't add anything. Balfour, one name, like Madonna or Cher, I asked, voice mild. His eyes narrowed, his shoulders a little tense. He'd been too easy to rattle. He had the stare down and the sense of menace, but he was just muscle. Scary looking and knew it, but maybe not much else. Rex intervened. I thought you'd be taller. He made it a joke with his happy-to-meet-you voice. Balfour's shoulders had relaxed, the tension draining away. They'd worked together before, and Rex knew that his partner was not the most stable cookie in the box. I met Rex's eyes. Balfour would be a problem if things turned messy. He'd overreact. Rex wouldn't. I heard Ray's voices, one of them a woman. Shit. I told Mrs. Bennington's lawyers to keep her home. They'd either ignored me or been unable to withstand her winning personality. The nice plainclothes policeman was talking to her, his voice calm but carrying in a low, wordless rumble, as he apparently tried to keep her 50 feet away from Conroy. Weeks ago, she'd slapped the lawyer, and he'd bitch-slapped her back. She'd then put a fist to his jaw and sat him on his ass. That was about the time the court bailiffs had to step in and break things up. I'd been present for all the festivities because I was a part of the court settlement, sort of. Tonight would decide the issue. If Gordon Bennington rose from the grave and said that he died by accident, Fidelis had to pay. If he admitted to suicide, then Mrs. Bennington got nothing. I called her Mrs. Bennington at her insistence. When I referred to her as Miss Bennington, she nearly bit my head off. She was not one of your liberated women. She liked being a wife and mother. I was glad for her. It meant more freedom for the rest of us. I sighed and walked across the white gravel driveway towards the sound of rising voices. I passed the uniformed cop leaning against his car. I nodded, said hi. He nodded back, his eyes mostly on the insurance people, as if someone had told him it was his job to make sure they didn't start coming over. Or maybe he just didn't like the size of Rex and Balfour. Both men had him by 100 pounds. He was slender for a police officer and still had that untried look in his face, as if he hadn't been on the job long and hadn't yet quite decided whether he wanted to be on the job at all. Mrs. Bennington was yelling at the nice officer who was barring her way. "Those bastards have hired her. And she'll do what they say. She'll make Gordon lie, I know it." I sighed. I'd explained to everyone that the dead don't lie. Pretty much only the judge had believed me, and the cops. I think Fidelis thought my fee had ensured their outcome, and Mrs. Bennington thought the same. She finally spotted me over the cop's broad shoulders. In her high heels, she was taller than the officer, which meant she was tall, and he wasn't very. He was maybe 5'9", tops. She tried to push past him, yelling at me now. He moved just enough so that he blocked her way, but didn't have to grab her. She banged against his shoulder and frowned down at him. It stopped her yelling for a second. "Get out of my way," she said. "Mrs. Bennington," his deep voice grumbled. "Ms. Blake is here by order of the court. You'll have to let her do her job." He had short gray hair, a little longer on top. I didn't think it was a fashion statement, more like he hadn't had time to go to the barber shop in a while. She tried to push past him, and this time she grabbed him as if she'd move him out of her way. He wasn't tall, but he was broad, built like a square, a muscular square. She realized quickly that she couldn't push him, so she moved to walk around him, still determined to give me a piece of her mind. He had to grab her arm to keep her away from me. She raised a hand to him, and his deep voice came clear in the still October night. "If you hit me, I will handcuff you and put you in the back of the squad car until we're all finished here." She hesitated, her hand raised, but there must have been something in his face, still turned away from me, that said clearly that he meant every word. His tone of voice had been enough for me. I'd have done what he said. Finally, she lowered her arm. "I'll have your badge if you touch me." "Striking a police officer is considered a crime, Mrs. Bennington," he said in that deep voice. Even by moonlight, you could see the astonishment on her face, as if somehow she hadn't quite realized any of the rules applied to her. The realization seemed to take a lot of the wind out of her. She settled back and let her cadre of dark-suited lawyers lead her a little way from the nice police officer. I was the only one close enough to hear him say, "If she'd been my wife, I'd have shot myself, too." I laughed. I couldn't help it. He turned, eyes angry, defensive, but whatever he saw in my face made him smile. "Count yourself lucky," I said. "I've seen Mrs. Bennington on several occasions." I held out my hand. He shook it like he meant business. Good, solid. "Lieutenant Nichols, my condolences on having to deal with..." He hesitated. I finished the sentence for him. "That crazy bitch? I believe that's the phrase you're searching for." He nodded. "That is the phrase. I sympathize with a widow and children getting the money that's due to them," he said. "But she makes it awful hard to sympathize with her personally." "I've noticed that," I said, smiling. He laughed and reached into his jacket for a pack of cigarettes. "Mind? Not out here in the open, I guess. Besides, you've earned it, dealing with our wonderful Mrs. Bennington." He tapped the cigarette out with one of those expert movements that longtime smokers use. "Gordon Bennington rises from the grave and says he offed himself. She's going to go ballistic, Miss Blake. I'm not allowed to shoot her, but I'm not sure what else I'm going to be able to do with her." "Maybe her lawyers can sit on her. I think there's enough of them to hold her down." He put the cig between his lips, still talking. "They've been freaking useless, too afraid of losing their fee." "Fucking useless, Lieutenant. Fucking useless is the phrase you're searching for." He laughed again, hard enough that he had to take the cigarette out of his mouth. "Fucking useless. Yeah, that's the phrase." He put the cig between his lips again and took out one of those big metal lighters that you don't see much anymore. The flame flared orangey-red as he cupped his hands around it automatically, even though there was no wind. When the end of his cig was glowing bright, he snapped the lighter shut and slid it back into his pocket, then took the cig out of his mouth and blew it a long line of smoke. I took an involuntary step back to avoid the smoke. But we were outdoors, and Mrs. Bennington was enough to drive anyone to smoke. Or would that be drink? Can you call in more men? They won't be allowed to shoot her either, Nichols said. I smiled. No, but maybe they can form a wall of flesh and keep her from hurting anyone. I could probably get another uniform, maybe two, but that's it. She's got connections with the top brass because she's got money. May end up having a lot more after tonight. But she's also been fucking unpleasant. He seemed to relish saying the F-word almost as much as smoking the cigarette, as if he had to watch his language around the grieving widow, and it had hurt. Her political clout getting a little tarnished? I asked. The papers plastered her decking Conroy all over the front page. The powers that be are worried that this is going to turn into a mess, and they don't want the mess to land on them. So they're distancing themselves in case she does something even more unfortunate, I said. He took a deep, deep pull off the cig, holding it almost like someone smoking a joint, then let the smoke trickle out of his mouth and nose as he answered me. Distancing. That's one word for it. Bailing, jumping ship, abandoning ship. He was laughing again, and he hadn't finished blowing out all the smoke, so he choked just a little, but didn't seem to mind. I don't know if you're really this amusing, or if I just need a laugh. It's stress, I said. Most people don't find me funny at all. He gave me a look sort of sideways out of surprisingly pale eyes. I was betting that they were blue in sunlight. I'd heard that about you. You're a pain in the ass and rub a lot of people the wrong way. I shrugged. A girl does what she can. He smiled. But the same people that said you could be a pain in the ass had no trouble working a case with you. Fact is, Miss Blake, he threw the cigarette on the ground. Most said they'd take you as a backup over a lot of cops they could name. I didn't know what to say to that. There is no higher praise between policemen than they'd let you back them up in a life-or-death situation. You're going to make me blush, Lieutenant Nichols. I didn't look at him as I said it. He seemed to be gazing down at the still-smoldering cigarette on the white gravel. Zabrowski over at RPIT says that you don't blush much. Zabrowski is a cheerfully lecherous shit, I said. He chuckled, a deep roll of laughter, and stomped out his cigarette, so that even the small glow was lost in the dark. That he is, that he is. You ever met his wife? I've met Katie. Ever wonder how Zabrowski managed to nab her? Every damn time I see her, I said. He sighed. I'll call for another squad car. Try for two uniforms. Let's get this done and get the hell away from these people. Let's, I said. He went to make the call. I went to fetch my zombie-raising equipment. Since one of my main tools is a machete bigger than my forearm, I'd left it in the car. It tends to scare people. I would try very hard tonight not to scare the bodyguards or the nice policemen. I was pretty sure that there was nothing I could do to scare Mrs. Bennington. I was also pretty sure that there was nothing I could do to make her happy with me. Chapter 3. My zombie-raising equipment was in a gray Nike gym bag. Some animators have elaborate cases. I've even seen one who had a little suitcase that turned into a table like a magician's or a street vendor's. Me, I made sure everything was packed tight so that nothing got broken or scratched up. But other than that, I didn't see the point to being fancier than you needed to be. If people wanted to show, they could go down to the Circus of the Damned and watch zombies crawl from the grave with actors pretending to be terrified of them. I wasn't an entertainer. I was an animator. And this was work. I turned down Halloween parties every year where people wanted zombies raised at the stroke of midnight or some such nonsense. The scarier my reputation got, the more people wanted me to come be scary for them. I told Bert I could always go and threaten to shoot all the partygoers. That'd be scary. Bert had not been amused, but he had stopped asking me to do parties. I'd been trained to use an ointment spread over face, hands, heart. The smell of rosemary, like breathing in a Christmas tree. Still held great nostalgia for me. But I didn't use the ointment anymore. I'd raised the dead in emergencies without it, more than once. So it got me to thinking. Some believed it helped the spirits enter you, so that the powers that be could use you to raise the dead. Most, in America anyway, believed that the scent and touch of the herbal mixture enhanced your psychic abilities, or helped open them, so they'd work at all. I never seemed to have any trouble raising the dead. My psychic abilities were always online for animating. So I still carried the ointment just in case, but I didn't use it much anymore. The three things I did still need for animating were steel, fresh blood, and salt. Though the salt actually was to put the zombie back in the grave once we were finished with it, I cut my paraphernalia down to the absolute minimum, and recently I cut it down even more. And I mean that cut part literally. My left hand was covered in little bandages. I was using the clear ones so I didn't look like a tan version of the mummy's hand. There were larger bandages on my left forearm. All the wounds were self-inflicted, and it was beginning to piss me off. I had been learning how to control my growing psychic powers by studying with Marianne, who had been a psychic when I met her, but had become a witch. She was Wiccan now. Not all witches are Wiccan, and if Marianne had been another flavor of witch, I wouldn't have had to cut myself up. Marianne, as my teacher, shared some of my karmic debt, or so her group, Reed Coven, believed. The fact that I killed an animal every time I raised the dead, 3-4 times a night, almost every night, had made her coven rant, rave, scream, and basically lose it. Blood magic is black magic to a Wiccan. Taking a life for magical purposes, any life, even a chicken's, is very black magic. How could Marianne have tied herself to someone who was being so evil? They demanded to know. To help Marianne's karmic burden, and mine, the coven assured me. I'd been trying to raise the dead without killing anything. I'd done it in emergencies without an animal to sacrifice, so I knew it was possible. But, surprise, surprise. While it was true that I could do my job without killing anything, I could not do it without fresh blood. Blood magic is still black magic to Wiccans, so what to do? The compromise was that I would use only my own blood. I wasn't sure it would work, but it did, for the recently dead at least. I'd started out slicing up my left forearm, but that had rapidly lost its appeal, since I needed to do it 3 or more times a night. Then I'd taken to pricking my fingers. Just a little blood seemed to be enough for those dead under 6 months. But I'd run out of fingers, and my arm had enough scars already. I'd also found that when I practiced left-handed shooting, that I was slower, because the freaking cuts hurt. I would not cut up my right hand because I couldn't afford to be slower with my right. I'd pretty much decided that, while I was sorry I had to kill a few chickens or goats to raise the dead, the animals' lives were not worth my own. There, I've said it. A totally selfish judgment call. I'd really hoped the tiny cuts would heal instantly. Thanks to my ties to Jean-Claude, Master Vamp of the city, I healed fast, very fast. The little cuts didn't heal fast. Marianne said it was probably because I was using a magically charged blade to do the cutting, but I liked my machete. Truthfully, I wasn't 100% sure that I could raise the dead with only a prick of blood, without a magically charged blade. It was a problem. I was going to have to call Marianne and tell her I'd failed the Wiccan test of goodness. Why should they be any different? Most right-wing Christian groups hated me, too. I glanced behind me at my audience. 2 new uniformed police officers had joined Lieutenant Nichols and the first officer. The police stood in the middle of the 2 groups, which had been allowed to come close enough to the grave to hear what the zombie would say. It was way closer than 50 feet, but both parties needed to hear Gordon Bennington, or so the judge had ruled. The judge in question had actually joined us, along with a court reporter and her little machine. He'd also brought along 2 burly-looking bailiffs, which made me think the judge was even smarter than he looked, and I'd been pretty impressed before. Not every judge will take zombie testimony. For tonight, Lyndall Grave was court. I was glad the court TV hadn't gotten wind of it. It was just the kind of weird crap that they like to televise. You know, transsexuals custody case, female teacher rapes 13-year-old boy student, pro football player's murder trial. The O.J. Simpson trial had not been a good influence on American television. The judge said in his booming court voice, which echoed strangely in the flat emptiness of the cemetery, "Go ahead, Miss Blake. We're all assembled." Ordinarily, I'd have beheaded a chicken and used its body to help me sprinkle a blood circle, a circle of power, to contain the zombie once it was raised, so it wouldn't go wandering all over the place. The circle had also helped focus power and raise energy. But I had no chickens at the moment. There was a chance that if I tried to get enough blood out of my body to walk even a small circle of power, I'd be finished for the night, too dizzy and too lightheaded to do anything else. So what's a morally upright animator supposed to do? I sighed and unsheathed the machete and heard several gasp behind me. It was a big blade, but I'd found that in beheading a chicken one-handed, you needed a big, sharp blade. I started at my left hand and tried to find a space that was bandage-free. I put the top edge of the blade against my middle finger, the symbolism was not lost on me, and pressed. I kept the machete too sharp to risk drawing the blade down my finger. It would be a bitch to need stitches because I'd cut too deep. The cut didn't hurt immediately, which meant I'd probably cut deeper than I wanted. I raised my hand so the moonlight fell on it, and I saw the first dark welling of blood. The moment I saw it, the cut hurt. Why was it that everything hurt worse when you realized you were bleeding? I began to walk the circle, holding the steel point downward, my bleeding finger flat to the earth, so that the occasional drops would hit the ground. I'd never truly felt the machete carving the magic circle through the ground, through me, until I stopped killing animals. It had probably always been like a steel pencil tracing my circle, but I'd never been able to feel it over the stronger rush of the death. I felt each drop of blood that fell, felt the earth almost hungry for it, like rain in a drought. But it wasn't the moisture the earth drank. It was the power. I knew when I'd walked the entire circle around the headstone, because the moment I touched the place where I'd begun, the circle closed with a skin-tingling, hair-raising rush. I turned to face the headstone, feeling the circle around me like an invisible trembling in the air. I went to the headstone, which was at the far end of the circle. I tapped the headstone with the machete. Gordon Bennington, with steel I call you from your grave. I touched my bloody hand to the cold stone. With blood I call you from your grave. I moved back to the far edge of the circle at the foot of the grave. Hear me now, Gordon Bennington, hear and obey. With steel, blood, and power, I command you to rise from your grave. Rise from your grave and walk amongst us. The earth rolled like heavy water and just spilled a body upward. In the movies, the zombies always crawl from the grave with reaching hands like the ground tries to keep them prisoner. But most of the time, the earth gives freely, and the zombie simply rises to the top, like something floating to the surface of a liquid. There were no flowers to get in the way this time. Nothing for the body to trip over, as the zombie sat up and looked around. One thing I had noticed with not killing the animals was that my zombies weren't as pretty. With a chicken, I could have made Gordon Bennington look like his photo in the paper. With only my own blood, he looked like what he was, a reanimated corpse. He wasn't awful. I'd seen much worse. But his widow screamed long and loud and began to sob. There had been more than one reason I wanted Mrs. Bennington to stay home. The nice blue suit hid the chest wound that had killed him, but you could still tell he was dead. It was the odd color of his skin, the way the flesh had begun to sink into the bones of his face. His eyes left too round, too large, too bare, so they rolled in their sockets, barely contained by the waxy flesh. His blonde hair was patchy and looked like it had grown, but that was illusion, caused by the shrinking of the meat of his body. Hair and fingernails do not grow after death, contrary to popular belief. There was one more thing I had to do to help Gordon Bennington speak. Blood. The Odyssey speaks of blood sacrifice to get a dead seer's ghost to give Odysseus advice. It is a very old truism that the dead crave blood. I walked across the now solid ground and knelt by his puzzled, wizened face. I couldn't smooth my skirt down and back because one hand was full of machete and the other was bleeding. Everyone got a nice long glimpse of thigh, but it didn't really matter. I was about to do the one thing that disturbed me the most since I stopped sacrificing poultry. I held out my hand towards Gordon Bennington's face. Drink, Gordon, drink of my blood, and speak to us. Those round, rolling eyes stared at me. Then his sunken nose caught the scent of blood, and he grabbed my hand with both of his and lowered his mouth to the wound. His hands felt like cold wax with sticks inside. His mouth was almost lipless, so his teeth pressed close in my flesh as he sucked at my hand. His tongue whipped back and forth on the wound like something separate and alive in his mouth, feeding from me. I took a deep, steadying breath. Breathe in and out, in and out. I would not be sick. Nope, I would not embarrass myself in front of this many people. When I thought he'd had enough, I said, "Gordon Bennington." He didn't react but kept his mouth pressed to the wound, his hands clutching my wrist. I tapped the top of his head gently with the side of the machete. "Mr. Bennington, people are waiting to talk to you." I don't know if it was the words or the tap of the blade, but he looked up and slowly began to pull back from my hand. His eyes held more of him now. The blood always seemed to do that, fill them back up with themselves. "Are you Gordon Bennington?" I asked. We had to be all formal. He shook his head. The judge said, "We need you to answer out loud, Mr. Bennington, for the record." He stared up at me. I repeated what the judge had said, and Bennington spoke. "I am, was, Gordon Bennington." One of the upsides to raising the dead with only my blood was that they always knew that they were dead. I'd raised some before where they didn't know that, and that was a bitch. Telling someone that they were dead and you were about to put them back in the grave. Real nightmare stuff, that was. "How did you die, Mr. Bennington?" I asked. He sighed, drawing in air, and I heard it whistle because most of the right side of his chest was missing. The suit hid it, but I had seen the forensic photos. Besides, I knew what a mess a 12-gauge shotgun makes at close range. "I got shot." There was a tension behind me. I could feel it over the buzz of the power circle. "How did you get shot?" I asked, voice calm, soothing. "I shot myself going down the stairs to our basement." There was a cry of triumph from one side of the crowd and an inarticulate scream from the other. "Did you shoot yourself on purpose?" I asked. "No, of course not. I tripped. Gun went off. So stupid, really. So stupid." There was a lot of screaming behind me, mostly Mrs. Bennington yelling, "I told you so, little bitch!" I turned and called. "Judge Fletcher, did you hear all that?" "Most of it," he said. He turned that booming voice on overdrive and shouted, "Mrs. Bennington, if you will be quiet long enough to listen, your husband has just said he died by accident." "Gail?" Gordon Bennington's voice was tentative. "Gail, are you there?" I did not want a tearful reunion on top of the grave. "Are we finished, Judge? Can I put him back?" "No." This from Fidelis Insurance Lawyers. Conroy stepped closer. "We have some questions for Mr. Bennington." They asked questions. At first I had to repeat them for Bennington to be able to answer, but he got better at answering. He didn't look any better physically, but he was gathering himself up, being more alert, more aware of his surroundings. He spotted his wife and said, "Gail, I am so sorry. You were right about the guns. I wasn't careful enough. I'm so sorry to leave you and the kids." Mrs. Bennington came towards us with her lawyers in tow. I thought I'd have to ask them to keep her off the grave, but she stopped outside the circle, as if she could feel it. Sometimes the people that turn out to be psychically gifted surprise you. I doubt if she was even aware of why she stopped moving forward. Of course, she was holding her hands tight to her body. She was not reaching out to touch her husband. I don't think she wanted to find out what that waxy-looking skin felt like. I couldn't blame her. Conroy and the other lawyers tried to keep asking questions, but it was the judge who said, "Gordon Bennington has answered all your questions in detail. It's time to let him get back to rest." I agreed. Mrs. Bennington was in tears, and Gordon would have been too, except his tear ducts had dried up months ago. I got Gordon Bennington's attention. "Mr. Bennington, I'm going to put you back now. Will Gail and the children get the insurance money now?" I glanced behind me at the judge. He nodded. "Yes, Mr. Bennington, they will." He smiled, or tried to. "Thank you, then. I'm ready." He gazed back at his wife, who was still kneeling on the grass by his grave. "I'm glad I got to say goodbye." She was shaking her head over and over, tears streaming down her face. "Me too, Gordy. Me too. I miss you." "I miss you too, my little hellcat." She burst into sobs at that, hiding her face in her hands. If one of the lawyers hadn't grabbed her, she'd have fallen to the ground. "My little hellcat." Didn't sound like a term of endearment to me. But hey, it proved Gordon Bennington had really known his wife. It also really proved that she would miss him for the rest of her life. I could forgive her a few temper tantrums in the face of that much pain. I squeezed on the wound in my finger and thankfully got a little more blood. Some nights I had to reopen a wound or make another one to get the zombie put back. I touched my bloody hand to his forehead, leaving a small dark mark. With blood, I bind you to your grave, Gordon Bennington. I touched him with the edge of the machete, gently. With steel, I bind you to your grave. I switched the machete to my left hand and picked up the open container of salt that I'd left inside the circle. I sprinkled him with salt, and it sounded like a dry sleet as it hit him. With salt, I bind you to your grave, Gordon Bennington. Go, and rise no more. With the touch of the salt, his eyes lost their alertness. He was empty as he lay back on the earth. The ground swallowed him like some great beast had ripped his fur and he was just gone, sunk back into the grave. Gordon Bennington's corpse was back where it belonged, and there was nothing to distinguish this grave from any other. Not so much as a blade of grass was out of place. Magic. I still had to walk the circle backwards to uncast it. Normally, I don't have an audience for that part. The zombie goes back in the grave, everyone leaves. But Conroy of Fidelis Insurance Company was arguing with the judge, who was threatening to cite him for contempt. And Mrs. Bennington was not in a condition to walk yet. The police were standing around watching the show. Lieutenant Nichols looked at me and shook his head, smiling. He walked over to me as the circle went down, and I began to clean my new wound with antiseptic wipes. He lowered his voice so the truly grieving widow wouldn't hear him. "You could not pay me enough to let that thing suck my blood." I half shrugged, holding a gauze over my finger so it would stop bleeding. "You'd be surprised what people pay for this kind of work." "It ain't enough," he said, an unlit cigarette already in his hand. I started to give some flip answer when I felt the presence of a vampire, like a chill across my skin. Out there in the dark, someone was waiting. There was a gust of wind, and there was no wind tonight. I looked up, and no one else did, because humans never look up, never expect death to fall upon them from the sky. I had seconds to say, "Don't shoot! He's a friend!" before Asher appeared in our midst, very close to me, his long hair streaming behind him, his booted feet touching down. He was forced to make a half-running step to catch the momentum of his flight, which brought him to my side. I turned and put myself in front of his body. He was too tall for me to cover all of him, but I did my best, moving us so that if anyone shot at him, they'd risk hitting me. Every policeman, every bodyguard had drawn a gun, and every barrel was pointed at Asher and at me. Chapter 4. I stared at the half-circle of guns, trying to keep an eye on everyone at once and failing, because there were too many of them. I kept my hands out from my body, fingers spread, a universal sign for I'm harmless. I didn't want anyone thinking I was going for my own gun. That would be bad. "He's a friend," I said, voice a little high, but otherwise calm. "Whose friend?" Nichols said. "Mine," I said. "Well, you ain't my friend," one of the uniforms said. "He's not a threat," I said, pressing my body back enough that I could feel Asher in a long line against me. He said something in French. Everybody gripped their guns a little tighter. "English, Asher, English." He took a deep, shuddering breath. "It was not my intent to frighten anyone." Not too long ago, the police were allowed to shoot a vampire on sight, just for being a vampire. It had only been 5 years since Addison versus Clark had made vamps alive again, at least to the law. They were citizens with rights now, and shooting them without just cause was murder. But it still happened now and then. "If you shoot with me in the way, you can all kiss your badges goodbye." "I don't have a badge to lose." It was Balfour. Of course, being tough, but he had a big gun to go with his big talk. I looked at him. "If you shoot, you better kill me, because you won't get a second chance." "Nobody's shooting anybody," Nichols said, and I was close enough to hear him mutter, "Damn it," under his breath. He'd moved his gun to point at the bodyguards. "Put the guns down, now." The other policemen followed his lead, and suddenly the circle of guns was pointed away from me and at Balfour and Rex. I let out a breath I hadn't realized I was holding and sagged a little against Asher. He knew better than to have surprised a bunch of humans, especially policemen, by flying into their midst. Nothing freaked people out like seeing vampires do things that were impossible. He'd also spoken in French, which meant he was scared enough or angry enough to have forgotten his English. Something was very wrong, but I couldn't question him, not yet. First get out of the line of fire, then fix the rest. We were standing so close together that his wavy golden hair brushed against my own.